I'm Bill Penn, for those of you who don't know me, and I thank you for coming to the Michigan Writers' Night, which is also our announcement and our readings for our Creative Writing Awards. Our judge this year was Susan Berry, who is sitting up here in the front row. She's a literary agent. She runs the Berry Swain Agency in New York, and she was kind enough to, with what we pay judges, volunteer practically to read the manuscripts. And she said she's not going to speak. She said if you want to take a picture of her, you'll have to get her over here. She said she enjoyed reading all of the manuscripts quite a bit, and she thinks a number of the winning ones are publishable, I believe is the word she used. So I think that's a high compliment coming from a literary agent. A number of things I need to go over is Michigan State University, as you know, does not give out checks. The people who have won money tonight will receive money against their college accounts. So being me, I went and printed you up little checks, which I will hand to you as you come up here. They're not worth diddly, and if I have the amount wrong, I'm not liable. Nonetheless, Lucille Yergalitis, who's the departmental administrative assistant, has copies of these checks. And what we need to do now is, if you did win first, second, or third place, or if you did win a prize tonight, by tonight at midnight, I need your PIDs on email. My email address is just penn@msu.edu. So if you did win, go home sometime tonight and just send that email. Tomorrow I will send the PID over, which Lucille will match up with the winners' names on the photocopied checks. What else do I need to do? I want to make sure that you all understand the process of judging for the Jim Cash Awards especially, but for all of our literary awards, and that is you submit manuscripts and the faculty, the creative writing faculty, vets them. They read through them and they rank them. In this case, this year, I chose to send the vast majority of those ranked manuscripts on to Susan. There weren't that many of them. And all Susan got were manuscripts with codes on the front. She had no idea who was who. Even when she emailed me the winners, she had to put P-1, P-2, CNF for creative nonfiction, -1. She had no idea, and she still doesn't have an idea. So she will meet you as you come up, or afterwards, after you've gotten your prize. And of course, let's see, I'm sorry. You know, standing in front of an IH class, 300 people, I can do it fine. Somehow you people make me nervous. It's this group right over here and back there, and over here. Next year's faculty administrator will be Jeff Ray, who is in our creative writing program, is a filmmaker. If you don't know him, he's sitting at the back. Perhaps you can meet him. And that means that next year the Glendon and Catherine Swarthout Literary Prize will not be so literary. It will be for film script. That prize alternates genre, and pretty much the way we're doing it is alternating the genre to match up with the person who is administrating and handling the manuscripts. So next year, we'll have fewer literary prizes, but we will include film script finally. So I got some film scripts this year, but unfortunately we didn't have prizes. So the last thing I need to say to you is after this, I invite you all to my house. Of course, you don't know where it is, but I invite you to my house anyway. It's in East Lansing, and I can give directions to you very easily for a brief informal reception. There'll be alcoholic and non-alcoholic beverages and lots of food. I have a wife who believes in lots of food, so I have a feeling there's going to be more than any of us could possibly consume. But you're welcome to come over to get to my house. You simply go north on Gunson till it dead ends. You turn right on Bircham, and you take your first left, and that's Lantern Hill. You follow it around to the right, come to a stop sign, and go around to the left, and we're the fifth house on the left. It's a lot easier than it sounds. The number is 963 Lantern Hill, but you all are welcome. So with all that said, I think what we will do is I will start with the third place winner in each category. In the case of the Lawson Prize, there is only one winner. And I will ask that one winner in the Lawson Prize's case, but also the first place winners, to read from their manuscripts briefly, and I expect we will be done approximately at 6 o'clock. So I hope that's agreeable to most of you. For the last, feels like in the envelope, please. For the Lawson Prize this evening, the best literary essay written by an MSU student, we have Jared Gerling. Jared, would you please? Did you bring a copy of your work? You were supposed to. Let me find your check first. That's what you want most of all.
I'm out of here.
Then you're out of here. Hold on to that. Don't lose it. Sweet. You're lucky I brought them. Where'd you go? Sorry, I hadn't planned to sort through these.
That's yours.
Sorry. It's all right. Please.
All right. Hi, everybody. I'm a rower here at Michigan State on the crew team, so that influences a lot of my life and what I do. So it's always in my head, so I figured I'd give it a shot and write about it.
All right.
4 years to live, 6 minutes to die. The butterflies in my stomach felt more like angry hummingbirds. Lane 6, give me half a stroke. My heart was thrumming in my ribcage. We have alignment. We will be going on a 5-count command. I sat up and moved to 3-quarter slide, that cocked position where the rower's legs are bunched almost completely to the front end and the oars extended out in front of him. I met the eyes of my coxswain briefly. She gave me the slightest of nods, her eyes fierce, her expression grim and determined. All rowers sit ready, the official said. I heard my stern fore breathing in slow, measured breaths. My bow fore, I could only presume, were doing the same. I forced my hands to relax around the oar handle. Rowing with a death grip like that can cause cramping and worse. 5. I glanced over to my right. Wisconsin. Beyond them, Purdue. 4. I looked to my left. U of M. Temple University. Army. 3. I got my head back into my shell and tensed my body for that first stroke, the first of a couple hundred. 2. Grand final. Varsity 8. 2,000 meters to go, 6 minutes to die. 1. Breathe. Row. David Halberstam, in his book, The Amateurs, follows the lives of amateur rowers, all of whom have Olympic aspirations. In it, he describes rowing as a process of tearing yourself down every day at practice and then voluntarily waking up the next morning to do it all over again. Halberstam compares the lives of collegiate rowers to those of soldiers who knew terrible hardships and sacrifice that only a few soldiers could understand. And I quote, during their college years, the oarsmen put in terribly long hours, often showing at the boathouse at 6 a.m. for pre-class practices. Both physically and psychologically, they were separated from their classmates. Events that seemed earth-shattering to them, for example, who was demoted from varsity to the junior varsity, went almost unnoticed by the rest of the students. In many ways, they were like combat veterans coming back from a small, bitter, and distant war, able to talk only to other veterans. I found that Halberstam was right. The sport of rowing takes something more than just physical prowess or being as strong as an ox. It takes mental prowess as well, and having a will that's more like a vein of iron running through the rower's core. More, it takes sacrifice. One of our favorite sayings that we stole from a t-shirt at a regatta in Cleveland is, I can't, I have crew. The first few weeks and months you have to get used to your free time being slowly siphoned away like air from a balloon. You have to realize that this is a commitment, a very, very large and taxing commitment. The sport chews up and spits out more athletes than a farmer chews tobacco. If you can hang on for those first few months, you know that you'll have that iron will needed to hang on to the last, even if you get there and you can't breathe. The first 40 strokes, I came to the realization I wasn't going to make it. This was normal. This is how every race starts. Needles were pushing themselves into my legs on every stroke. My shoulders ached. My arms were going to fall off. My chest heaved and my lungs burned. And this was only the first few hundred meters. This was with 5 minutes or so left to go. I was sitting stroke. That is the person that the other 7 guys follow. I was in the stern. My coxswain hunched over in front of me, and we had taken it off the line like monkeys on speed. Those first 40 strokes are about pure horsepower, prying the boat to its maximum speed and then hanging on to every stroke after that. Water flew all around me. Coxswain screamed. Are you giving up now? This race just started. I want everything you have right now. Empty the tank on every stroke. It was chaos, regimented into six lanes. If I knew I could just hang on, and my guys behind me did the same, we might be able to finish this race alive. The flyer I got read, we aren't a varsity team, we just roll like one, which is true enough. But the part that really caught my eye was a smaller caption at the bottom. Three words that always seem to suck people in no matter what's being advertised. No experience necessary. So I was sucked. At the informational meeting, the coach, soon to become the illustrious coach, said something that kind of made sense. Kids go to college to get their college experience. Now you can interpret this any number of ways. Getting drunk, partying, hanging out with friends, more getting drunk, more partying, all that stuff, I guess. But these experiences are no longer unique, if they ever were. Almost every kid comes to college thinking he's going to do things that no one has ever done, experience things that no one has ever experienced. But that's bullshit. That's all been done before. So I opted to try something new, something only a few have dared to try. Brave the harsh realities of the collegiate rowing world. Or maybe I was brainwashed as well, but in a different way. There's the halfway mark. Focus, guys, focus. We're right here. We're pulling away. Keep these boats off of us. Power 20 for pushing it through. If I finished, I know I was going to have to be dragged from the boat. We were settled at a 34 strokes per minute. To keep that up for 6 minutes is crazy, but it's how we were trained. The occasional grunt blasted out from one of the guys behind me. To do anything more, it was just a waste of energy. There is no yelling or screaming by rowers in a race. We had two seats on the other boats in the race with 1,000 meters left. We were halfway home. I couldn't really feel my legs. I felt the smooth wood of the oar handle and the fire building in my lungs. I could feel the run of the boat as we tapped our blades out of the water, the click of the oar locks as 8 blades were feathered off at the same time. We glided to the front end, arms extended, knees bending. We were 8 giant springs ready to unload all of our energy through the water. Our blades sliced back into the water in unison, and we unloaded. Legs, back, arms, tap out, do it again. I could only see my feet. I never look up in a race. How many kids with genuine college experience can say they've competed physically with some of the best teams in the nation? How many have anything to show for 4 years of classes, homework, and horrible papers besides a diploma and some hazy memories of a drunken weekend that could be any weekend, that could be every weekend? I nearly lost my mind my freshman year during the winter training. Since crew is a year-round sport, you obviously can't row outside in January. We head indoors to our erg room, a small concrete bunker with 15 or so ergs. Ergometer is a technical name for rowing machine. They're the devil. We sit on these machines for 2 hours a day, every day, from Thanksgiving break till spring break. The coxswains yell at you. The coach yells at you. You stare at numbers. You stare at the wall. You hurt. You spit. You puke. It is the most mind-numbing, physically demanding experience an athlete can endure. But day in and day out, there we are. My freshman year, I nearly went insane. I was in huffing and puffing like a dying locomotive. My legs had feeling again, but it was more than needles. It was swords skewering my legs. It was us in one other boat. I didn't know who. We both had a few seats on the other 4 boats in the race. I risked a glance up at my cox. She was shouting into the mic that's connected to the speakers in the boat. Most of the race, I don't hear what she says. It's like someone yelling underwater. I pick up the inflections in the general meeting. Numbers help, as when she counts out a 10 strokes, or something to that effect. I want you to pick it up 6 beats in 2 strokes. We sprint from here to the finish. I want you to die. I want everything you have. 1. I strain my arm muscles just that little bit more. 2. I push that much harder with my legs against my stretchers. My muscles stood out like cords on my thighs. We made the move, but I knew I wouldn't make it. My mind was screaming for me to stop, but we kept going like some kind of macabre insect with 8 legs crawling its way down the river. We were a machine running in the red, but we were almost home. To balance both the sport and the academic life is like juggling fire. If you screw up on one, the other's going to come down and burn you. But if you can manage it, it makes you all the tougher. I come home from practice in the morning, shower, eat, go to class. Sometimes I fall asleep in class, but I still go and I still study and I still learn. I work at papers. I work at practices. Always active, always in motion. The spring months fly by as we compete every weekend to come home to class after class. Emotionally, I become drained. Physically, I'm perpetually exhausted. My mind, my pen blurs, my mind sweats. But I keep going, keep moving, keep writing. My vision is blurry. Sweat pours from every part of my body. I hear coxswain screaming. I can barely hold on to my oar. I can barely push my legs. I wonder absently how the rest of the guys are doing. I pull, I keep pulling. Then, is that a horn? Paddle down, guys. Good job. Hell yeah, guys. That was amazing. My head swims and I fall over backwards. I gulp down air. My hand drags through the water as I let go of my blade. I hear cheering. I see a bird fly into the sun to disappear within its hot eye. We did it. I made it.
Is this yours, Jared?
Oh, no. Where's that?
But stay there for a second. Now, we, Pat O'Donnell, the chairperson of our department, and other people, and I have been through the rules several times, and there is nothing in the rules of these awards that says that a person cannot win something twice. So I'd like to give third place in the Jim Cash Fiction Award as well to Jared. You don't have to read now. You're cool, Jared. You're done. That's north on Gunson, right on Burchill. Okay, just get that part. We'll finish the rest in a minute. Second place in the Jim Cash Fiction Award goes to Teal Amthor Schaefer. And first place goes to a young woman who has never worked with me and will pay for it, Colleen Farrow.
This is what I want to read today. It's an excerpt from a longer short story, and it's called The Only Private Place. The narrator, Robin, she's on a road trip from Michigan to Georgia with her mother and grandmother, and they're going to attend a funeral in Georgia. So on this drive, which takes place during the summer, Robin keeps having flashbacks to the school year and a boyfriend named Jason. So I'm going to read some of the flashbacks, even though they aren't exactly in the order that they appear in the story. So. And the title, again, is The Only Private Place. The most pathetic thing I did to get Jason's attention, I joined our high school's Model United Nations team because I overheard Jason telling Mr. Davy he was interested. Mr. Davy grinned and then told him when and where the first meeting was. I tried to act surprised to see Jason there. "It's Robin, right?" he asked. I turned 15 shades of red. The only other time I'd blushed this badly was when Mr. Davy asked me to briefly tell the class the primary cause of the Civil War, and I had answered, staring at Jason's neck, because the colonists were tired of Britain's control. "Yeah," I said, smiling. He sat next to me and asked if he could be my partner. I couldn't believe it. "Sure," I smiled even bigger. "Which country do you want to represent? Do you have one in mind?" I glanced casually down at the list of possible countries. "Liechtenstein," he said. "Oh," I said and nodded. "Very cool." He laughed when I didn't say anything else. "You have no idea where that is, do you?" I froze. "Don't worry about it," he said easily. He sat back in his chair, extended his legs forward, and crossed his feet at the ankles. After months of being with him, I learned this body language meant that he was happy, relaxed. After months of being with him, I learned what every movement of his body meant. "It's this itty-bitty country scrunched in between Switzerland and Austria, literally scrunched in there." He pushed his hands together to show me how his crooked knuckles could represent geography. I stared at his hands because they were easier to look at than his face. "Pretty much nobody knows where it is. It's something like 60 square miles. I only know about it because it borders Austria. We stopped there to get gas a few times. The whole country is owned by one prince, a constitutional monarchy, I think it's called. It'll be really easy to represent because all we have to do is think about whether Switzerland would like whatever it is we're talking about. and then we'll know what Liechtenstein would feel. Okay, I said. Talking came ridiculously easy to him, which contrasted sharply with my shyness. I never talked to anybody in classes, except the girlfriends I'd had since the third grade. For some reason, Jason seemed to want to talk to me. It seemed like everyone in school knew him, too. Walking down the hallway with him between classes or during lunch, teachers would ask him questions about his parents. Seniors from the varsity team would high-five him, invite him to parties, tell him his swing was improving. Nobody else in school had ever been to Europe, let alone live there. I asked my friends Lauren and Becky if they knew where Liechtenstein was, and they had no idea either. After the first UN meeting, I rushed home to look up Liechtenstein in the encyclopedia, avoiding nosy questions from my mother about how the first meeting went. I read the entire entry twice, mostly because it was only a few small print paragraphs. I had to laugh when I read the section about main goods exported, ceramics, and artificial teeth. We had our UN meetings every Wednesday at 4:30. The best part was that the meetings, which lasted only an hour, were held across town at the rival high school. That meant Jason and I traveled there together in his Volvo and usually wound up afterwards just driving. We'd stop and get soda or something and just drive around. He was the only freshman I knew who had his license. That alone made a lot of people think he was cool. I wasn't anywhere even close to having my permit. I'd never been in a Volvo either. That was a European thing too, I think. Driving with Jason was the first time I learned how amazing it could be to go wherever I wanted. While my parents knew I was with him, they of course didn't know where we were all the time. They just thought Mr. and Mrs. Kinsell, our UN advisors, filled several hours every week with intense study of international politics. UN meetings were held every other week, a second slight fact Jason and I forgot to divulge to our parents in order to spend more time together. Later, in the spring, the driving turned to parking. I'd always heard old people talk about parking and what happens when couples park. We'd started dating in November, gradually spending more and more time together. By Christmas, we were kissing all the time, with tongue. We would kiss for hours until I could no longer tell it was cold outside the car. I blushed all the way through January and February as we got more and more serious. But Wednesdays were still the best times, and we began to forego the sodas and just talk and kiss somewhere private. In April, our UN team had its annual conference in Washington, D.C. I was excited about the trip for weeks, just Jason and me. We would be alone, except that our advisors would be there, plus other student representatives from Sri Lanka, Japan, Egypt, a couple of other Middle Eastern countries. They all had actual issues to deal with. The worst thing about the country Jason and I shared was that women were not given suffrage until 1984, the year I was born. Every night on the phone, Jason and I talked about the trip, how we would sneak away for more privacy than we had ever known before. A few times, one of my parents would invade the line, and we would quickly change the subject to something more related to Liechtenstein. So you're saying we should focus more on relations to Switzerland than on Liechtenstein's strength as an agricultural superpower? It was so hard not to giggle as I heard my mother breathe. I could almost see her frowning suspiciously, carefully attempting to conceal her eavesdropping. Well, definitely, I would answer, trying to sound intelligent. I mean, I wouldn't really call such a small country a superpower by any means. I think its main goal as far as financial stability is to depend heavily on banking. I simply could not agree more. When we thought we were safe again, we'd start talking about what it would be like to make love, how it would be special because neither of us had ever done it. Do you think we would be all right at it? I asked once. Oh, I know we would be. I loved the way his voice got whenever he talked about love or making love. He would use that voice when telling me how beautiful I was, how he loved my brown hair and brown eyes. Freshman year, I got my braces off, and finally, my mother let me get contact lenses. When both those things happened, Jason kept telling me I was sexy, which started to make me self-conscious after a while. I want to make love to you, he would whisper into the phone, not even so his parents wouldn't hear him. He would just whisper because he thought that was the type of thing that needed to be spoken softly. Sometimes when he would whisper, I would think about the Lionel Richie songs my father often played for my mother. I never told him that, though. He would never think Lionel Richie was cool. He also didn't like to talk about how scared I was that I'd get pregnant. We use protection, he told me, like he was stating the most obvious and apparent fact known to man. We won't be stupid. I was scared and excited at the same time and counted down the days until the conference. Since it was held over a weekend, our team would be getting hotel rooms in D.C. the night between. That required permission slips from our parents that looked more like novellas. My father pored over mine after dinner one evening, and my mother pulled out her reading glasses, which she only does when she's reading the Bible or the Detroit Free Press. Finally, it was April, time for the conference. We left early that Friday morning, meeting in the parking lot of our school to pile into the 15-passenger van. According to our arrangement, Jason was to bring the condoms. When I saw him for the first time that morning, I eyed his duffel bag, wondering where in that bag they were tucked away. And with his polo shirt and khaki pants, and with his shaving cream and razor. I think the first person you are in love with completely fascinates you in a way no other human ever will. We exchanged glances, but of course could not talk about lovemaking until we were alone, except in code. "Did you bring the information about agriculture?" I asked nervously. He smiled bigger than I had ever seen him. "Of course I did. I want us both to be ready to use the proper statistics in our defense of Liechtenstein." Driving to D.C. was awful because our advisors, the Kinsells, took turns at the wheel in order to get there overnight. Jason and I slept uncomfortably on one of the bench seats, our arms and legs falling asleep in turns. For the hours between 2 a.m. and the first signs of daylight, I let Jason sleep with his legs stretched over my lap, his head buried in a pillow against the window. His legs completely cut off the circulation in my own, and for hours I could not feel half of myself. I wondered if I would ever get the feeling there back again. At the time, I thought it was symbolic that I would care more about his comfort than I did my own feelings, like something from a novel. I finished reading The Bell Jar during the drive down because I couldn't put it down, especially when I realized Esther was about to lose her virginity to a man she adored simply because of his name. That moment, that was when I knew we were making the right decision. That morning was how I knew I loved him, letting him rest like that. I love Jason. Of course I should make love to him. Watching him sleep, my legs tingling, my eyes staring at the road in between Mr. and Mrs. Kinsella's torsos, one white line after another, like walking. It wasn't too hard to sneak out of the conference to meet up with Jason as we had planned. I was sharing a room with Mrs. Kinsell and the only other girl on the Model UN team. I volunteered immediately for a rollaway because it was closer to the door than either bed. As we turned the lights out, I studied the neon green digits of the clock from my cot as they moved gradually from midnight to 1 a.m. Jason was in the lobby, sitting on a faux leather couch and watching for me as I stepped off the elevator. His smile seemed to mirror my own nervous one. "Hi. Hi." He didn't get up right away, so I sat next to him on the couch. It was funny, but for all the planning we had done late at night, in the dark, over the phone, we hadn't actually talked about where we would go. Sitting on the beige couch cushions, I think we both realized the impracticality of it all. "Are you okay?" he asked. "Yeah, I'm fine." Jason, where? Yeah, I'm not sure. I started to tear up. I don't know why. I really hadn't a good idea of how it was going to happen, but I wanted it to be good, better than this. I guess I just thought it would happen if this was what we both wanted. "Yeah, me too," he said. "Stupid, huh? I mean, here we are, in a hotel, and we can't even..." He smiled and put his arm around me, noticing I was about to cry. He was wearing just a white t-shirt and striped pajama pants. He leaned back into the couch, his long legs stretched out. He looked at me and whispered, "I love you, Robin. I really love you. You know that, right?" And then I just smiled. "I know you do. I know. I still want to do this." "Me too," he said. "I'm just afraid it's not going to be what either of us want. I wish we could get a room or something." We sat there for a second, and I leaned my head against his shoulder. I think the first person you get physically close to stays with you in a way you can't even imagine. For the rest of your life, every other person you hold and kiss, you'll be silently and secretly comparing to that first person. It's like your first love makes the imprint, and you judge all the others on how well they do or do not fit you like the first one did. Jason was familiar to me in this way. I reached across him with my other hand and hugged him around the torso. "Do you have the..." "Yeah, they're in my pocket." "Okay, good." As much as we hated it, the only place we could think to go was the bathroom. The hotel lobby had a huge unisex bathroom that locked. I went in, and several minutes later, as casually as possible, Jason entered. He bolted the door. "Okay," he said, exhaling. "Are you nervous?" This was not at all how I had pictured it. In all the books I had read, I'd never read about couples in love losing their virginity in a bathroom at a National Model UN conference. Even Esther, who wasn't exactly romanced by the math professor Irwin, at least met him on the steps of a library. "Maybe we should just start kissing," he said. "Sure." He stepped forward and we kissed in front of the mirror for a few minutes, holding hands. We were right in front of the mirror and I felt too self-conscious. Even though we were alone in the bathroom, whenever my eyes slipped open, I could see us kissing. It was weird, especially under the fluorescent light, and especially trying to kiss kind of quietly so no one would hear us or suspect us. Jason pulled away for a moment, breathing a little hard. He pulled his white T-shirt over his head and pulled his pajama pants off. He stood there in his socks and boxer shorts. He smiled and then stepped out of his underwear, too. "What are you thinking?" he asked suddenly. I'd never seen him this naked before. He looked silly, to be honest, wearing only his white socks and standing on the tile. There was something really clinical about it, as though I were a doctor and I'd asked him to take off his clothes and don a hospital gown. It felt more like I was going to inspect him or diagnose him with something instead of make love to him. I started to feel like losing our virginity to each other was something like getting tested for strep throat or bronchitis. "What?" "Nothing," I said. I took a step forward to kiss him, but it felt sterile, nothing like the warm, wet kisses we'd exchanged for so many months in his Volvo. I was thinking about how unromantic it was, how we would probably have to lay on the tile floor to do it. "Do you want to take off your nightgown?" I looked down at my plaid boxers and T-shirt. I heart New York. I didn't know what to think or feel, just was relieved that Jason was unable to know what was going through my head. I didn't mean to ruin the plans we'd made for weeks. I didn't want to hurt his feelings or make him feel bad. "What?" He moved his hands to cover his private parts, as though he was suddenly aware of his exposure. It wasn't like Jason to be like that, self-conscious and unconfident. And that was when I knew it wasn't going to happen, seeing him stand there, his hands covering his penis, white Hanes socks with red stripe at the toe covering his feet. "Jason," I started. "What? What's the matter?" Maybe he'd caught his reflection in the mirror and saw how silly he looked, too. "I don't know. I just..." But he reached for his underwear and pulled them hastily back on. He grabbed his pants and pulled them up and struggled to flip his T-shirt right side out to get it back on his body. He wouldn't even look at me. "Jason, please," I said, reaching for his arm. I wanted to hug him and feel his familiar body around me. "Please, don't be..." He did hug me, but only for a second. Then he quickly turned and unlocked and opened the door in one motion, no longer worried about who in the lobby might see us or how closely the night desk clerk was watching the unisex bathroom. Before I could move, he was running through the lobby, to the hallway, back up the stairs to his room.
I've reread everything that has won these prizes, and I have to say that I'm very impressed with your talent. Some of this is awfully good stuff, and I think I really enjoyed Colleen's story when I reread it, having vetted it, and then I reread it when I found out she was one of our winners. I do need to tell you that your work is in submission to the Red Cedar Review as of tonight. If they want it, they get it. Also, Peter Berg at the back from the MSU libraries is at the back of the room, and he needs you to sign copyright permission slips. So if you would make sure that you get that done this evening, that would be very helpful. Tomorrow, I want to remind you. Oh, wait, we went right on Bertram. Next, take your first left. Okay. You're now on Lantern Hill. You can't get lost. If you go past my house, you end up by a mobile gas station somewhere near Hazlitt Road. The Glendon Swarthout Prize has two places. It is also for a literary essay, and I hope you poets out there will become plain why I've saved poetry for dessert, I think, by the time the evening is over. Second place in the Swarthout Prize is the reason I asked Colleen to remain standing up here, because she is the second place winner. First place in the Swarthout Prize is a student who, along with Teal Amther Schaefer, has done yeoman's work, and John Spielberg, rescuing the Red Cedar Review this semester and last semester. Her first place winning is, I'm sorry, the first place winner is Jennifer Popa.
Thank you. My piece is actually me coming to terms with being raised Catholic. So it's entitled Constellation of Scabby Guilt. It was just last spring that the unimaginable happened. That fated Easter Sunday, I made a momentous and unforgivable error. At the fault of an old alarm clock that decided it didn't feel like ringing, I found myself late for church that morning. I was rushing around, attempting to get ready for Mass. Quickly, I dressed in a new floral skirt and jogged to the car. It wasn't until I stepped inside the church that I realized I had somehow forgotten to put on underwear. In that moment of discovery, I heard an internal gasp and instantly felt the burdensome weight of my blunder. I sensed my cheeks flushing hot pink, mortified by the error. I knew this black mark on my soul was irrevocably permanent. Of all days to forget undergarments, I managed to do it on Easter Sunday. Instead of celebrating the resurrection of Christ, I was frantically worrying about a gust of wind surging down the pew. How dreadfully inexcusable it felt to slip up in the presence of the Lord. As a child raised within the confines of Sunday Mass and weekly catechism, I had experienced this guilt in heaping spoonfuls. This pantyless offense was indeed troublesome. No amount of confession could really take care of a wrongdoing of this magnitude. Catholic guilt, like a raging case of genital herpes, flared up in the absence of panties. I knew tiny clusters of guilty blisters were sprouting up in that very moment, hidden from view. The tingling guilt burned beneath my floral skirt. Fortunately, my secret was concealed, assuming no gust of wind had its way with me. The blow to my conscience was worsened because my heart was still bearing the weight of that C I got in my high school morality class. To this day, I claim that bitch of a nun lost my paper. Or perhaps this particular case was exceptionally painful because I never really recovered from kneeling on the floor in the seventh grade to make sure my skirt was not scandalously a half inch too short. Nevertheless, blushing and with my thighs tightly clamped together, I walked to receive my cracker O Christ at communion. Even after Mass, when Father Dave approached me, commenting that it was nice to see me again, I dodged him by skirting around my parents to avoid his all-knowing powers. In those moments of guilty delusion, I questioned whether or not a priest might know that I had tainted this sacred day by bringing my uncovered genitalia to God's house. Even with great detachment from the Catholic Church, the guilt never seems to depart. Occasionally, each person will experience a flare-up, just like any classic case of herpes. The outbreak is inevitable, no matter how far one separates himself or herself from Catholicism. Though it is a nuisance and can be emotionally traumatic, there is no cure. Catholic guilt is inevitable, and at times, it is of epidemic proportions. This was not my first instance of Catholic guilt, nor would it be my last. My grandmother once gave me a plastic Jesus hanging on a crucifix for my bedroom. "Your very own savior," she said. At the time, I thought it was perhaps the tackiest figure I had ever encountered, yet obligingly, I hung it above my doorway. It was only a matter of time before the cheap J-Team paraphernalia broke. Jesus separated himself from the cross and dove to the carpet. I was relieved because finally the hideous gift could be disposed of, and yet, when I went to deposit Jesus in the garbage, I simply couldn't do it. I couldn't throw away Jesus. Oh, I tried to throw him away. I did set him in the garbage amidst a collection of wadded Kleenex and used Q-tips. He lay there, pathetically staring up at me. I could almost immediately feel a constellation of lesions speckling my genitalia. After sprouting, the blisters opened to their weeping stage. It was painful, to say the least. I felt abdominal pressure, a swelling pain between my legs that crept down to my thighs, and the inevitable discharge from the raw sores. My hands started trembling. As I leaned toward my degraded Jesus, I plunged through the snotty tissue to retrieve my humiliated Messiah. As soon as he was in my palm, the sores closed, dried, crusted, scabbed, and departed without so much as a scar. That was 12 years ago, and today, Jesus resides in a Tupperware container in my sock drawer. Where does this guilt exist? How does it come to be? To suffer from an infection of such great proportions, it has to be instilled at birth. Yes, baptism. That's when they get everyone. When one is too young to run away, tearing down the aisle, they are bathed in holy water. Yet this holy water is what contains the Catholic simplex virus. It is placed on the soft part of a baby's scalp, and this is where the virus is absorbed unknowingly. An innocent infant doesn't realize at the time all the scabs of guilt that will weigh on his or her conscience in years to come. This child will grow to stand and kneel and stand and kneel. This will be followed by some reciting of prayer and the message that confession will absolve each and every one. As if by doing 10 Hail Marys, I will fix that time I hit my little brother when I was 7 years old. The interesting thing about Catholic guilt is that one is not always aware of it. A majority of its victims are oblivious to the fact they even suffer from the ever-plaguing virus. Like herpes, symptoms are not always visible. It is recurring and there is no cure to date. There is merely a relief of symptoms through a dozen Our Fathers, Sores No More, or attending Ash Wednesday Mass, where a fat-thumbed priest will smudge ashes on one's forehead. Although even these are merely symptomatic solutions, the guilt resides in nerves below the skin's surface. Without warning, the virus will be reactivated from its latent sleep and will wreak havoc on one's vulnerable conscience. It will remain with the nerve cell for life, a predator, deep below the surface, patiently waiting to pounce. Once activated, the red bumps may last for days or weeks, depending upon the severity of one's guilt. Catholic guilt is internalized. We suffer intensely from the speckled horror of an offense we may or may not have committed. The guilt shifts between the active and dormant stages. In my first Eucharist, I understood transubstantiation and the idea that the host merely represents Jesus instead of his actual flesh. Yet I remember thinking that the Lord tasted a bit stale. With my hands clasped together, I returned to my pew to kneel and attempt to swallow the bland-tasting Lord. It was there that it occurred to me that the priest was always a bit stingy with his bowl of Lord. He never shared it with non-Catholics or even divorced parents. It wasn't until I discovered the work of a comedian named Jane Cook that I really had true value and perspective for those initial stale judgments. When Cook said, "The Lord's a little stale today. You should check the date on that Lord," I couldn't help but laugh. Even in that harmless state of laughter, I could still feel the guilt flaring up beneath my clothing. At some point, when leaving church, it occurred to me that my dad clearly had no idea what was going on in Mass. On a weekly basis, he would quiz me about what Father Dave said in the homily, and initially, I was nervous in the hopes of properly reciting the key point. It didn't take me long to realize that my dad was just dozing off in Mass and wanted the Cliff Notes version. So that's when I started messing with him. I would dramatically make up elaborate homilies involving gory bloodshed, a knocked-up Virgin Mary, and a stern warning from the priest about punishing one's children. My mother, who hadn't fallen asleep, would give me a severe look. She knew damn well that wasn't at all what Father Dave had said. With a hint of disappointment, her lips tightly disapproving, her eyes said, "You should know better, Jennifer Lee Popa." My mother could cause an outbreak of pus-filled sores simply by making eye contact. The only other time I received this look was during Mass, when I was a self-appointed priest in training. At some point, I memorized the priest's part during the ceremony of Mass. If he bowed or raised his hands at his sides, I did the same. When he used that booming, sing-songy voice, the one that isn't quite singing but isn't quite talking when speaking to God, I whispered it to myself. I imagined myself in conversation with God, although he never said much of anything except an occasional clarification. "You know what would be great? If you could just stand and kneel 13 times, that would really show me how much you love me," he explained. I learned all of the moves and all of the priest's lines. I was so excruciatingly bored, I didn't just mind-numbingly recite the prayers of the churchgoers. I acted out the whole hour-long Mass right there in the pew. I became a one-woman show, complete with deep bowing capabilities, erect posture, a solemn face, and the quintessential commanding demur. That's when it came, the look. Nothing can create such an instant outbreak of Catholic guilt quite like a disappointed mother. In that moment, itchy sores broke out, visibly marking my body. I squirmed with discomfort, breaking from her gaze. There really is nothing we can do to prevent an outbreak. Until Catholic Valtrex makes it to the market, we have no solution. No amount of distance from Catholicism can prevent such painful eruptions, and even with daily preventative medication, they may still occur. We must live with the understanding that it resides deep below the surface, calculating each genital ambush, and it will remain when those nerve cells for life. If you're Catholic and you're reading this, I bet you can feel those blisters forming even now. In the words of Dane Cook, "I'm going to hell, but you're laughing, so you're coming."
Now for the poetry. Third place in the Jim Cash Poetry Prizes goes to Victoria Shaw. Is she here somewhere? Second place goes to Emily Malloy. And last, and hardly least, first place goes to Colleen Farrow. While Colleen makes her way up here, the number is 963. It's on your left. And tomorrow at 4:30 in 213 Morrill Hall, the graduating seniors in the creative writing emphasis of the English department will be reading from their thesis. I urge you to come and to support your fellow creative writing students and maybe hear some writing that's awfully good.
Okay, so I guess this first one is a prose poem, but it's a poem that I wrote about the death of my grandfather about a year ago. So it's called 21. The man handing the flag to my grandmother said, "A grateful nation presents you this." Not just him. He crouched for her, sitting on a folding chair, legs sinking into mud. Before this, I watched the fabric fold, a tight triangle, and though I saw the shots they fired, I could not see their sound. I felt it move the ground. Two Rush County honor guards tucked the bullet blanks deep within the pocket of stars. A 21-shot salute, seven firing each three times at shapes I used to see in clouds. Before the casket sunk into earth, in the same way, my grandmother tucked her yellow tulip in the pocket of his suit, the only man she knew. Before this, 1942, she married him at my age, 21. Later, I helped her place the flag in an angled box, meant for a mantle, the way the casket perfectly fit his frame. I knelt for her. She watched me secure the back with a Phillips, with small screws, and I saw his face in the glass's reflection, not the face of a soldier, uniformed, bloody, dying, but the old man of a casket at his wake, made up, hands crossed, gold watch still ticking, the one sign of life. The second one is actually a sestina, which is a form poem, and it's rather long, but a lot of the lines repeat themselves, the end words repeat themselves a lot, so that would be why they do that. It's just called I Know This. The rain stopped hours ago. It is the perfect time for this. I will be running soon, no doubt. Pleased to be a part of things so concrete. Earth, blacktop, road. In a life, I swear, has few things so steady as asphalt under feet. I will be dreaming nonstop as I begin, aware only of darkness, of wetness, of an absence of light or the physical presence of anything at all meant to guide me. I think even I don't know how beautiful this will be, how much it has to give me. The night, that is. She's a very good friend. That might sound stupid, my friend, the night. She is more of a companion and someone who watches me as I am running. I don't think she's ever asked me what from. People make good friends, but even the great ones have limitations. I know this. The night has befriended the road in a way that makes me jealous. Theirs is time spent without the presence of light. It is the sun who kills the night in the morning. She ends it, stops it from dreaming. My legs will move fast and my feet touch down. In this steady way, my dreaming, ceaseless, will carry me these miles. I know this. I am not strong enough this night to make it alone. I never am. To run is to become instantaneously light, though gravity and my body will try to weigh me down. I will feel, running, my limbs in pain and my heart quickened too. I know every aspect of the road. She always welcomes my weight. I will feel my breath come fast at first, then even, in a steady, in an out way, that will make me wish everything in life, even the simplest things, were this easy. The best thing about my life is the dreaming. I know this. That may sound stupid. But without the dreams, I am afraid the road would never know the feel of my feet, the weight of my body at the onset of night. I am down another road now, one that stretches on for many miles. I am running for myself. My body feels different somehow in the darkness than it does in the light. It must be because I see only feet and my swinging hands in the evening's dim light. I have to trust the way my body feels, not the way it looks. My long legs are even in stride. They synchronize like the wheels of a good machine. So often, running makes me wish I was a wild Mustang on Montana prairie land, free and dreaming, not of life as the way I wish it were, but of every day and every sleepless night, spent running hard and making, with shoeless hooves, my own real sense of road. That may sound stupid, me, a wild horse, but I have spent so much of my life on a road I did not carve for myself. I have felt enough of weight to want to be completely light and reckless. I want this for myself. I know this. I am in love with the way night does not ask where all these dreams will take me, nor the road from what I run, even though she must be curious by now. I am exhausted and would stop, if not for dreaming, of a somewhere, a place I have never been, where I only go and reach when running. I wonder, as I return home, running down the most familiar road, I know, if even wild horses run this much in dark, or if this night they are only dreaming, in the distance, the beginning of light. This last one's a lot shorter. It's from my thesis, which is kind of loosely about, it's a series of poems that in some way relate to my mother. So this one is called Minus My Mother. My father, 6 feet, 4 inches tall, 236 pounds, 56 years old and 4 months, minus my mother, waiting. For dinner, he would feed me, minus my mother, salad from a bag, ravioli, broccoli. Frustrated at my meatless eating, at my ceaseless food on plate pushing, and me at his ground beef glaring, he asked, "Can you eat anything else?" "No, I can't." One evening I came home to him, alone on the couch, wrinkled, shrinking, without my mother, waiting. My barely worn striped sweater, woolen, dryer shrunk, occupied his hands the way his wife's absence had taken new permanent residence. In a scene someone else seemed to compose, lacking her, he asked, "Can you still wear this?" "No, I can't."
A couple of last things. I forgot to say that on Friday in 300 Human Ecology, which is a name that always brings strange visions to my mind, the 300 Human Ecology, starting at 11 a.m. and running intermittently through 3, will be Martha Bates, who is the acquisitions editor for the MSU Press, giving a presentation. Professor Aldrich, Marsha Aldrich, who is the former director of the Creative Writing Emphasis, and two people from Gale Publishing in Detroit, all to talk to you about the occupation, the business, the publishing scene, and I guess getting published. So if you are able to make that, please feel free to drop by. I think Ruth Maurer has it set up so that people can come and go according to their class schedule or according to their work schedules or whatever. So do try to come out to that as well. And finally, I would like you to have a round of applause for Susan Berry and thank her for judging our contest. And thanks for coming.